Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Tuesday, the 14th of July, 2020. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Charlotte Henry. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, hello. We appear to have been left unsupervised.
Yeah, all we've got is access to the record button, so we'll see how this goes. No, that wasn't evil laughter from either one of us at all. I actually wanted to start, Charlotte, with a sort of a quick hit that we've got some speculation about what the first machines are that are going to roll out with Apple Silicon. Whatever it is they're calling it. Yeah.
That one, the one with Apple's own chip, and it won't be a surprise that Ming-Chi Kuo, the renowned, should I put that in inverted commas? He's well known. He's a well-known Apple analyst, and he's written a note that speculates on the first ones, and it looks like it's going to be a MacBook Air, we think. A 13-inch MacBook Pro and MacBook Air. Apparently they're coming this year.
Okay.
According to Ming-Chi Kuo, and then they're going to be followed up with a 14.1-inch and 16-inch MacBook Pros in 2021.
Interesting.
Kind of makes sense. Our good friend and colleague John Matalaro has said from the start that one of the first things was going to be the MacBook Air. He also got the fact that a mini would be involved in the development kit and so on, right? So... it makes sense. But yeah, that's apparently what we've got on the way. He says it's going to be a 13.3-inch MacBook Pro, and that will go into mass production fourth quarter of this year, and an ARM-based MacBook Air either the same quarter of this year or possibly the first quarter of next.
Okay.
And then there'll be a mini LED 16-inch MacBook Pro and a 14.1-inch MacBook Pro that'll also have a mini LED display.
You know,
so there we go. And those are likely to come second or third quarter 2021 for those who want to mark a spot in their diaries.
Well, the ARM rumor, you know, because it continued to persist and wouldn't go away and wouldn't go away. Now we know why.
It was true.
Because it's real. The interesting thing to me about that is in conjunction with the 16-inch MacBook Pro. And the reason is because if they were going to make a fundamental shift like that with changing the size of the laptops, right? So it's a whole new size of machine. You know, we didn't have 16-inch before. You know, we had the 17-inch laptops for a while, and then those, you know, eventually sort of aged out of usefulness. Unless you are a friend of mine who hung on to his until the 16-inch came out, and the minute it was available, he bought one because he wanted more than 15 inches worth of screen, and now he has it. So the interesting thing to me is before the 16-inch laptop was a reality, I always sort of presumed that if Apple was going to make a change like shifting to their own processors, that's when the size would happen, that we would get maybe 14-inch laptops and 16-inch laptops once Apple was developing their own processors for those, because that would be, you know, that would be a big sea change, and it would be very easy to tell, right? Is that a 14-inch machine? I know you have Apple. I know you have an Apple processor.
Right.
Is it a 13-inch machine? You have Intel. Okay. You know, we used to have that with the logo on the machine, or, you know, when there were a wider variety of indicators on the outside of the computer, what kind of computer it was. They've kind of had the same design for a while, you know. So you know, now the only sorts of lines you have are like, does the Apple logo light up, right? Okay, then you have a much older machine, or,
right.
You know, whatever.
Oh, I remember when it lit up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was a cute little thing that your computer could do. It was great. So, to me, it was surprising when the 16-inch came out because I assumed it would go hand in hand with Apple's own processors. And so when that didn't happen, I started to more heavily discount that rumor, which, as we've seen now, is reality. So what I am the most curious about in all of this is what Tim was referring to in the dub footage that we saw, where he said, like, we also have Intel machines, you know, we haven't even announced yet. So.
Yeah, that was interesting. And we did touch on that during our slightly brain fried hot take episode.
Sensory overload, yes.
Right. But that's been buzzing around my head, actually, that line since the keynote, and that you're right, that that'll be worth watching out. But the devices that Ming-Chi Kuo spoke about specifically involve Apple Silicon.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see where those go. So there's a PSA. He's come out with another estimation, prediction, whatever you like to call it. Mm-hmm. We have a second PSA for you, and that is that the public betas of iOS 14 are out, if that's a thing that you are into.
Yeah, they came out last week. Yeah. Of iOS 14, obviously, iPadOS 14 as well. Mm-hmm. We were discussing off air, and we thought we'd hit record because I want to have a play with it. I don't have an old iPhone lying around. I'm trying to get hold of one, mm-hmm. because I want to test it.
Yeah,
I do not, and please, people, do not put iOS 14 public beta on the phone you use every day.
Yeah, the daily driver, good thing. Whatever it is that you call it, your actual phone. I've heard people call it if they have multiple devices. Your actual phone is not where to put it. Yeah, no.
So I'm trying to obviously avoid doing that.
Yes.
And that's fine. But I went through the list of devices it's compatible for. Maybe I'll write this up over on themacobserver.com because it's kind of takes a little bit of digging around to find out what is what.
Yes.
But the oldest device iOS 14 and therefore the public beta mm-hmm. works on is the iPhone 6S.
Yes.
And the non-iPhone device it works on is a 7th generation iPod Touch.
Yes.
Which got Kelly all nostalgic. Well, because she does love an iPod Touch.
I love the iPod. I still do. I still have a white slab with a video screen that I use in my car all the time. But I love the iPod Touch. For real. To this day, I have a 30-pin connector in the USB connector in my car.
Actual...
No. No. The car I drive does not have CarPlay. So
nice.
Yeah. So I just use this. It's great. It generally, like, it mostly lives in the armrest because my car lives inside a locked garage, so it's not a big deal. But the reason I have a very soft spot for the iPod Touch in particular is because that was basically the device that powered AppCamp. So when we were when AppCamp was a thing, that was how we were able to do things. We could deploy to it. Nothing needed a service contract. Nothing was, you know, under a 2-year subsidy, which was a very common thing, you know, when AppCamp was getting off the ground. And it made a very easy thing. And I knew a ton of developers who were really excited about the iPod Touches because they ran the same operating system as the phone. And for a lot of years, they were also the same size and dimensions as the phones. So when we went from iPhone 4 and 4S size to iPhone 5 and 5S size, and we stayed there until this, I think the 5 was it. And then I think it was the 6 that got bigger and stopped having the sort of 90-degree edges, which I do like. Anyway, I have a couple of them on my desk right now, so I'm like looking at them and fondly. So the 5, the nice thing about the size of the iPod was that it, like, as the iPhone grew, the iPod Touch grew as well. And so for $200, because that's how much it is, we looked it up beforehand, if you just want to get the mm-hmm. smallest one, a 32-gigabyte iPod Touch is $200. And there's no service contract to worry about. You don't have to worry about, like, activating a line on your cell phone account or anything like that. You don't have to worry about a carrier or unlocking it or anything like that. And it's a great test device. And I used to know people who, like, every other year when they went to WWDC, they would go to, when it was still in San Francisco, they would go to the Apple store across the street from where DubDub was held and pick up a new iPod Touch. Like, it's been 2 years, so I'm going to get a new one. And then they would install beta 1 on that device. And, like, if it broke or came, you know, if the operating system was terrible in the first beta, it didn't matter because it wasn't your phone. Yep. You could still take calls, make calls, get messages, all of that. So I think as a test device, it still really has a very solid place for a lot of people. Now, there are a lot of things it doesn't have, like a great camera or Face ID or even Touch ID. It's just a straight up home
button. It doesn't have touch light. The camera is not as bad as you actually think it is.
No.
So there's a 720p FaceTime camera, and you can record, which, like, considering they're still selling that thing on Macs, you can't really argue about.
Exactly. That's what I'm laughing at is it's the same one as in the laptop. Yeah.
Right. And there is a 1080p HD camera for as well
on the back.
It's 30 frames a second, and you can do slow-mo at 120 frames a second. It's not bad for a device that starts at $199.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were kind of looking into it and thinking, well, that would be a nice way to test the new operating system.
I'm
trying to get a hold of an older iPhone.
Yeah, it's a great way to do that if you don't have that option, or if you're looking at getting into developing or something like that. Like, a really nice way to be able to deploy to a device sort of consequence free is when that device is not the one that you carry around with you. Your carry phone, your daily driver, what have you. If you have a better name for that, observations@macobserver.com is where you can send it.
To finish up our conversation on that, it's just worth pointing out that the Retina display on the iPod Touch is only 4 inches, which is obviously, it is now quite different purport. If you're actively developing, not just playing with an operating system, it is obviously a different setup now.
Mm-hmm. And it is
the
smaller.
Screen sizes and the dimensions are exactly, it's all different to an iPhone now, which is kind of a shame, but... Anyway.
Yeah, there's basically an additional row of icons on a Face ID phone as opposed to what's on the iPod Touch. So,
yes.
I counted them up earlier. Anyway, right now what I'd like to do is take a minute and tell you about our sponsor this week. Our sponsor this week is Raycon. And Raycon is a company that makes earbuds. And everybody could really use a pair of great wireless earbuds. I mentioned Charlotte yesterday. Charlotte is absolutely a person in the market for... a true wireless earbuds, you know, no cord around the back of your neck or anything. But Charlotte, I know you are not a fan of the stems on the AirPods. And there are a number of brands out there that are kind of doing that. Raycon does not. And the other thing Raycon doesn't do is charge you a truckload of money. So they start at about half the price of other premium wireless earbuds. You can take calls with them. I've been using a pair of Everyday E25. They've got awesome battery life. It says 6 hours of playtime. I've easily gotten that. They paired to my phone really easily. They connected really nicely. There's a lot of bass in them. So know that if you like to listen to bass heavy music, these are probably the earpods for you. And they're also very compact. So the case is smaller than a regular AirPods case, and they're really comfortable to carry around in your pocket. They're small and tuck in your ears really comfortably, like I said, and they're definitely worth checking out. So if you do want to check them out, you can get 15% off your order, whether you get the Everydays like I have or something else. You can get 15% off at buyraycon.com/TDO. That's buyraycon.com/TDO. 15% off your earbuds. And we'd like to thank Raycon for sponsoring the show today. Now, the other thing we want to talk about is, Charlotte, you read an interesting article from Joanna Stern that led you on a journey of your own.
Yes. So as listeners and readers may recall, back in January, maybe it was a new year thing, new year, new me.
Possibly.
Safari and I broke up. We decided it was, you know, it's a new year, we're not going to continue our relationship.
I remember.
It was hard, but it's okay. And I found ways to replace Safari in my life, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. But, and, you know, there's lots of, and I'd been using Chrome. There are numbers of reasons for it. There's links to my original piece in the column I wrote today. I used to get a lot of error messages in Safari. It didn't work that well for me on my Mini for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it was just driving me mad, and I'd had enough. So I went, okay, I'm using Chrome. And it worked. And I was conscious because... I've spoken to Andrew Orr about
like
I'm joking.
Hi, Andrew.
Because Chrome privacy you get the drift.
Yes.
And that was a concern for me. It was also a concern that when I'm jumping between devices, it's kind of a pain on using Chrome. It sort of defaults to Safari and like,
yeah,
on iPad OS and iOS, you can't really, you automatically open links in Safari, even if you're mainly using Chrome and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did it and it's been fine for 6 months. And then I read Joanna Stern's column, which I think came out over the weekend. And she like me, was kind of not quite irritated by Safari. And she'd been using Chrome, but did some tests. And not surprisingly, and this is no surprise, Safari is obviously much better and power efficient, never mind the safety stuff, which we already know about.
Yeah.
So she conducted some tests and found that Safari used between 5% and 10% less RAM than Chrome, Firefox and Edge on a Mac. And it kept her 13-inch MacBook Pro running between 1 hour and 2 hours on a charge, longer on one charge.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing I've noticed with Chrome is the battery. The battery life.
Right. And she thought her laptop was cooler and quieter as well.
Oh, yes.
I'll be honest. I'm using a mini and I've just touched it again and we're using Safari and Discord and it still could cook breakfast on it. But anyway. I know they say never go back, but I'm going to give Safari a second chance.
All right.
And well, the privacy thing has always, about Chrome, has always bothered me.
Yes.
It has always bothered me, but there are Google services that I use every day that obviously work better in Chrome.
Yeah. I was going to say, you're a very recent Android user, so you have a Google account and all that stuff kind of in there. Like you were using that already, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like a bazillion other people, I have a Gmail account. Like a bazillion other people, I have YouTube, like use YouTube. We use whatever, the Google web chat facility every day, which used to work better in Chrome. Interesting, it seems to be working okay in Safari at the moment.
Yeah.
Like there were reasons for using Chrome. But we'll see. I'm going to keep an eye on it. I'm going to, see how my setup works using Safari. See if, moving between devices is easier. See if performance improves. Obviously, I'm not using a device powered by battery.
Right.
Which was one of the big tests that Joanna Stern used. But mm-hmm. in terms of things like mass overheating and privacy, those things are totally relevant to me, and so I will be interested to see how it works. It's an interesting time actually, because you are going to be able to use a third-party browser in iOS 14 as your default.
Yes.
Our understanding is it has to be based on WebKit, mm-hmm. whatever browser that is, but you should, I assume, be able to use something like Chrome or Firefox or whatever. I'm sure that there will be versions of those that will work on iOS as the default. They're not going to miss that opportunity. It's also worth noting that actually Joanna Stern's column was quite a big fan of Edge, which mm-hmm. is Chromium and works on Apple devices, including iOS devices. So maybe that's another thing users want to look into. Yeah. Anyway, it's
that was the interesting thing to me in reading her article, was I did not realize there was a version of Edge for Mac OS. Mm-hmm. So that to me was very surprising. I thought her article was an interesting read, as you know, as she sort of stepped through all of the pieces. I've always found that it's much easier for me to have a whole truckload of tabs open in Chrome or in Firefox. Like, I will occasionally switch to Firefox for a while, and then something will happen in Firefox that doesn't work anymore, and I'll have to go back to Chrome for it.
Yeah, Firefox, I think, did well in terms of privacy.
Yes.
But I think is a bit of a battery drain, if I remember the results mm-hmm. of her test correctly. But there's lots of things to recommend Firefox, particularly on the privacy side.
Yeah. Hi, Andrew.
And, Andrew and I both played, I think, with Opera before, which is another. There's options out there, but the truth is that for obvious reasons, the simplest solution is jump, particularly when jumping through devices, is with Safari.
Yeah.
If you're only using Apple devices, that looks is increasingly becoming the best option.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. I'm going to be very interested to see how these things look on iOS 14, particularly as you're able to swap out the default. I think that's going to be interesting. And we'll find out if Charlotte can get her hands on an old phone or springs for an iPod Touch and puts the public beta on it. We'll find out more. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, and I'll let you know how my rekindled relationship with Safari goes.
I am sure we will hear about it either way. I have no doubt. So that's going to do it for us today, Charlotte. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah.
I'm your host, Kelly Gamon. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other and let's be careful out there.